Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal: enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not even going to be
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, a look at a very busy week after the governor's budget. But first, WISI was there. Administration Secretary Joe Brennan talks about pent-up demand that prompted Governor Evers to seek a building budget of $2.5 billion, three times the last construction budget of Governor Walker. And the Corrections Secretary says Minnesota cut its prison population in half, and Wisconsin could strive to cut its 24,000 adult inmates, followed by comments from a Minnesota prison official. Democratic Party Chairman Martha Lanning, in an exit interview, says it's exciting that so many young, talented women now serve in Congress and are running for president. And finally, Supreme Court candidate Brian Hagedorn says every judge has core personal beliefs. Wish I was there.
The last couple of capital budgets had narrowed significantly in the Walker administration. And I think there is, so when I talk about pent-up demand, it's not as if there weren't projects that were out there that people were interested in. And I think this governor has tried to listen to different organizations, listen to the system, made a significant investment in the system proposed in his operating budget, and we're following suit in the capital budget.
The state of Minnesota, our next door neighbor, for instance, at one time had a prison population that mirrored ours. Currently, they have around 10,000 people in custody in their state
facilities. We have 23, they have 10,000.
Yeah, we have 23, or closer to 24,000, and yes, they have 10,000. They've just flipped the model on its head, and they are just as safe as we are, and the cost for running those facilities is significantly reduced.
Prisons don't have to be criminogenic finishing schools for crime. Prisons were constructed and designed many years ago. And I can guarantee you that the guiding thought when correctional facilities were being built wasn't, how can we make this facility into a program-rich environment that optimizes the delivery of effective programming? Instead, it was security, isolation, and control.
I believe that women's voices are getting louder and louder. We're better than what is happening in the White House. That's why it just makes me proud to be hearing women stepping up and talking about what we can do to really make everyone's lives better, and not just Democrats' lives better. Everyone's lives better.
Every single judge who puts on the robe has personal views. Every single judge. The fact that I expressed some of my views when I was a law student doesn't make me unique in having those views. I can tell you, every judge has them. I think voters can look at my record and know that I am faithful to what I've said, that these are things that I didn't just come up with a few months ago as talking points. These are things that I have lived out, I have believed, and I have fought for years and years and years.
Efforts around human trafficking, again, begin in this building with some folks willing to shine a light on probably one of the most difficult conversations. This happens all across our state. We see it in every single county. We know that in the last year, there are at least 100 cases, 22 instances of the 39 instances of sexual abuse that we saw in out-of-home care were related to human trafficking. So these are sobering numbers.
1 week later, we can take a little longer look at Governor Evers' $83 billion, two-year, all-funds budget. So I'm just intrigued at the amount of the spending increase. First of all, when you go to $83 billion all funds, that's a 10% increase over the current two-year cycle. And then when you look at GPR, general purpose, general fund spending, it's up $2.7 billion. K-12 is 1.5 of that. Health services is $329 million of that. Local aids and tax credits is $280. That noted this from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. To help cover the spending, the budget would use both a net increase in income and capital gains. The additional GPR taxes, however, do not cover all of the proposed spending. Finally, the Policy Forum says the added expenditures could prove challenging to sustain. Now, we knew some of these numbers a week ago, but they still look pretty aggressive, don't they?
Well, Republicans are trying to, are hoping to start using this as the kind of the pushback to the Evers budget, right?
Yeah.
Every governor with his budget, it's a layup when you do that thing because you get all the headlines. You go out and tour the state. You kind of talk about all these good things. Like he's in Eau Claire this week, touting $109 million in the capital budget. But at some point, Republicans get their turn to kind of like start talking about the downside in their view, the increase in spending, the increase in taxes. You know,
the increase in borrowing, the 2.5.
Start pushing those
Joel
messages.
Brennan alluded to, excuse me.
So that's going to be part of this. But they're still diving through and kind of picking apart what's in there. Now, what's interesting is they're not going to do a lot of this stuff. So what can they do? That's the question we talked about last week. I still don't know. What can they get done? When can they get it done? And how they reach a compromise? I still don't know.
Okay, but you and I have been watching budgets for a few decades. Mm-hmm. Normally, a governor gets 80 to 85% of what they originally recommend. I don't smell that this time.
No. Now, the question still is, when Republicans talk about working off the base, which is basically current law, right? So use the base. How is that going to work? Will they really go through every single agency line by line and try to pick it apart? What's it mean to work off a base when it comes to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature? They do these papers that summarize what's proposed, what we have, what you can do. How does that work with them? I mean, it's all kinds of like really, truly like the minutiae of a budget. But the question I have is, what are they really going to do working off a base? Because like taxes, DNR, those things, education, I get that. But like every single agency, that's a lot of work. You know, they really want to go that way. You know, we'll see.
It is. And early this week, the governor was asked about the possibility of if the Republicans craft an entire budget that throws away everything he recommended, would he consider vetoing that budget? And let's listen to about 25 seconds of the governor's comments.
Now, I know there's some differences of opinion among Republicans and Democrats on these issues, but I think all of us just need to let the dust settle a little bit. I would hate to be put in the position, and I don't think the legislature wants to be in that position, of the governor vetoing an entire budget. I will do that if the budget is extraordinarily bad for our state.
Part of this issue, JR, is I'm beginning to suspect, first of all, let's credit the McIver News Service. They did, they and other news organizations put out the salaries of major cabinet secretaries, and some of them got up to, let me check, a $23,000 increase. And do you think the governor, when he was hiring to fill these key jobs, even considered what former Governor Walker paid them?
Good question. This is an example of not looking ahead and anticipating the optic that the Evers administration has at times struggled with. And let's be honest, every governor struggles at times with thinking this way, but you have to anticipate what it's going to look like. And here you have a budget that would spend a lot more, and he's paying his cabinet a lot more. Now, he defends it. He's saying these are qualified people.
We'll get to that in a minute. But let's talk about some of these. Administration Secretary Brennan, $1 less than the governor at $152,755. And Craig Thompson at $145,000, which I think is 10 or 13 higher than former Transportation Secretary Dave Ross. And you have two secretaries at $130,000, both of which are higher than their predecessors. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's all right. You know, Governor Walker, at times, they struggled to find people to fill these jobs because you would have to take a pay cut. Like Scott Neitzel, DOA secretary, I'm pretty sure he took a big pay cut.
Utility executive, too,
to go
join
be
the
DOA secretary. But there's a public service component to being in the cabinet, right? So you can do that for a couple of years. And oh, by the way, if you do it right for a couple of years, you can go out and make an even bigger salary
it
going forward.
It broadens your career portfolio, takes you back into the $300,000 and $400,000 a year.
Absolutely. But this just gives fodder to critics to kind of label Tony Evers as a big spender. Like, look, he wants to spend your tax dollars on this stuff, and he's even paying his cabinet more. It's an optic they could have avoided. I mean, maybe smaller increases, those kinds of things.
I understand. So now let's look at how the governor responded to the disclosure of these higher salaries for cabinet secretaries. These people run extraordinary, complex, large organizations. Many of them took a cut in pay to take these jobs. We want to have the best quality people, and sometimes it costs a little more money. The sniping from the Republicans, Representative Pat Snyder, it's disappointing that these increases come to his secretaries and his staff, while the middle class tax cut was vetoed by him. Okay, and then Senator Tiffany from the North Woods, I wonder what state government employees are saying who are seeing these significant increases. for the top of state government, and they aren't getting anything near those types of increases. The governor's budget recommends a 2% bump for state employees on this January 1 and then next January 1. Mm-hmm. So optics?
Yeah, again, optics. You know, it's something that it would behoove them to figure out how to get ahead of things and think down the road, not just immediately of what's going on.
Okay. Now, the growing controversy over the proposed secretary, Don Krim, who the governor has named to be the designee to lead the secretary of the Department of Safety and Professional Services. 2005, there was a police investigation where she got angry at her son and stabbed him to the point where blood was drawn, and there was a tentative felony charge of child abuse filed, but there was a deferred prosecution agreement that led to Krim admitting fault but no conviction for child abuse. I found it interesting. The State Journal reported that that was expunged from CCAP.
And there were more documents released to, I think, the Journal Sentinel talking about how there was some question about the validity or some questions about the foundations of the charge. But whatever happened, it's interesting talking to people so far. The response of, well, what's this going to mean for her? Okay. Will Republicans vote no on the nomination when it comes to the floor? So far, Evers is standing behind her, saying that he knew about it. This is interesting. He didn't know about the charge when he hired her at DPI.
Yes, sir.
But knew about it in the vetting process, called her an extraordinary person, and, you know, basically stood behind her in this. You know, a lot of times when this stuff comes out, you see the nominee say, I need to spend more time with my family. I've got a different obligation now. And go, but they're staying behind her for now.
Well, how do you think Ms. Krim did a damage control when her statement said, this incident was the most difficult and trying experience of my life. Despite this unfortunate incident from 14 years ago, I have a strong, caring relationship with my son. How does that play?
Interesting. I'm not sure yet. But if you look at the cabinet secretaries who have gotten grief so far, some kind of blowback, you have Thompson at Transportation over policy, right? Because
yes.
He supported gas tax hike before.
When he was at the Transportation Development Association.
The DHS secretary, in part because the number two person used to work for Planned Parenthood. There's a policy disagreement. This is the first one that has a personal issue that's arisen in the confirmation process that's caused concern. How does that play out? I don't know. And Republicans have to figure out, is it worth it to try and reject this person? Because if they go to a vote on the floor, the Democrats will all vote yes, you would assume, because it's their governor and it's his cabinet. So you only need three Republicans to confirm her. So how will the caucus respond? Will all 19 vote no? Will instead, which is my suspicion, like with Thompson, if there's a problem with him still, they just never vote on her. Because you can allow a person to continue serving, I believe, indefinitely without a vote. You don't think you need a confirmation vote, so maybe just don't do anything.
Well, Senator Campagna, who will chair the Senate committee next week that holds a confirmation hearing on Don Krim, said she will get a chance to explain this deeply troubling incident. The Senate committee will have to evaluate whether her actions are disqualifying. Of all the pending cabinet secretaries, do you consider hers most in jeopardy?
I don't know yet. It's hard to say because I don't know, you know, one, like how many of us were spanked as a child or disciplined with physical punishment, you know? 15, 14 years ago is a little bit different than we are right now. I heard that argument this week.
Yes.
I've also heard complaints from Republicans of what if Governor Walker had nominated somebody who had this on his or her record? How would that have been perceived? Might have been a different story. There's always a fear of a double standard in politics of like, well, if we had done this, it would have been a much bigger outrage. I don't know if there would have been a bigger outrage. And, you know, it was a long time ago and she's, you know, put out a statement. I don't know yet how it's going
to
play.
You alluded to it earlier. Let's listen to a short clip from the governor actually talking about his nominee, Don Krim.
Yes, I've known Don for several years, and I do stand behind her. When it was investigated, that incident, they found the charges to be unsubstantiated, and she was never... she's never found guilty of anything, and she's worked hard. She was part of the University of Wisconsin-Madison system before she came to work at the Department of Public Instruction. She's an extraordinary human being, and I do stand behind her. And I look forward to having the opportunity to talk to the legislators who may have concerns.
The Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, JR, released totals $35.8 million spent on all legislative races. So we're talking by the candidates, by the political legislative committees, and by third-party groups. This was up 27% in one cycle. $28 million was spent last time. But I want to focus just on the six Senate races that cost more than $1 million. Because when you look at Howard Markline versus Chris Marion in Senate District 17, $4.5 million for a job that pays, remind me, how much?
$50,000.
$51,000 or something?
Couple?
Yeah. What I find intriguing, we can walk down the 17th District, $4.5 million, 1st District, $4.2 million, 19th, the Roth versus Snodgrass, $2.3 million, the 5th District, Koininga and Henze, $2.2 million, Bernier versus Kapsner, $1.1 million, Democratic Senator Bewley versus Bowen in the 25th District, $1 million. Are there any limits anymore?
No.
No?
Don't forget.
You just said no.
Don't forget. Well, I mean, limits on what they can spend, yes, but like how high you can go. I mean, money can be found. I'm trying to think. I got here in 2000. I think the 98 race for Erpenbach's seat.
That was the first $1 million.
I thought it was.
And Erpenbach said, when third party groups get involved, I as a candidate lose control of the message. I never know what I'm going to wake up hearing about myself or my opponent.
And like 4 or 8 years later, he was basically unopposed. But it was an open seat, and it was, a closely divided Senate, so it became a focus of the money. Democracy Campaign also found record spending in the governor's race.
Yes.
And the AG's race. This is no surprise there's a record spending in the legislative races. They point to a common thing was the 2015 rewrite of campaign finance laws by Republicans, which raised individual contribution limits. Parties could always get unlimited contributions.
Yes.
But there's a cap, used to be, of $10,000 per year per donor to everybody, candidates, groups, everybody. That cap served as a de facto limit on party contributions. Well, that got thrown out by the courts. Mm-hmm. So they basically opened the door, this rewrite, to, parties can get unlimited contributions. They also can make unlimited transfers to candidates, which Governor Walker benefited from quite a bit from my research in this past cycle. It's all coming together to help drive up the cost of campaigns, plus inflation. Things just get more expensive over time, right?
Well, but the inflation rate was 2.6. It wasn't 28% increase.
Yeah.
When I look at these six Senate races, and when you look at what the individual candidates spent and the legislative candidate and the legislative campaign committee spent, they spent 36% of this total. 64%. Two out of almost every $3 was spent by third-party groups. And that's why I ask, sure, there's a limit on how much anybody can write a check for governor, the assembly, but there's no real limits anymore.
Oh, money is a finite resource. It flows where it's most useful. So, yes, things keep going up, but it's not like in 2 years we're going to see twice the spending. There are some limits of how deep the donors can go. But what's interesting to me, look at these races. Mm-hmm. How many of them were close?
Which one was the closest?
Koininga, I think, was 52-ish.
Yes.
I think Bewley's around that same neck of the woods.
Yes.
Others were the Bernier race, that one was put away kind of early. Democrats were telling me in September, October, the race is not going to happen. They still dropped $1.1 million on that race.
Right. And when I interviewed that candidate against Bernier, he looked at me and said, I had no idea what I was getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bad sign when you're in running for an open state Senate seat. Right. Okay. I want to go back now to our Attorney General, because it's the first. Let's talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
The first time that our Attorney General, Josh Call, joined in a national lawsuit, he joined 21 other attorney generals to oppose a U.S. Health Department rule that would prohibit any healthcare clinic that receives Title X funding from referring a patient for an abortion, or in some cases even discussing an abortion, and mandates a referral for prenatal care for every pregnant patient. In his statement, he said, all Wisconsinites should have access to safe, quality health care, including family planning services. If the new rules aren't blocked, quality health care will become less accessible. Now, he and the governor agreed to this. My question was, because of the lame duck bills, they didn't have to get legislative approval to file this suit, do they?
No. Withdrawing and settlements. Those
withdrawing
are the ones
and
have
settlements.
Oversight.
Right.
So, look, this is reflects elections have consequences. Brad Schimmel sued the Obama administration quite a bit.
Yeah.
You can count on Josh Call suing the Trump administration. Not as frequently, but probably in things like this, we're going to be joining with other states who are have Democratic AGs and stuff like this, whereas Schimmel's involved in suits with Republican attorneys general on issues that they disagree with the Obama administration about. It's just a reflection of the change in administration.
Right. And the spokesman, the leader of Wisconsin Rights Alive, said it's tragic. The Wisconsin Attorney General believes his role in protecting the citizens of Wisconsin includes protecting the nation's largest abortion provider, a reference to Planned Parenthood, and passing it off as access to health care. So we just have a flip from Attorney General Schimmel joining Republican other AGs and this one joining Democrats.
Yeah. Right? Plus you have a change in presidency, right? So it wasn't like Schimmel wasn't suing Trump a whole lot. So, and if there's Democrats in the White House after 2020, I don't think I'll be suing him or her a whole lot.
Right. Okay, let's go to your stock reports.
So wedding barns. This issue has been percolating
getting
for years.
Getting married in the wedding barn.
So, Tony Evers had been kind of mum about where he was going to be with this. Because remember, go back, under the Walker administration, they continued a longstanding policy of wedding barns, which when a private, is a private facility rented by private people, put on a private function, they don't have to have a liquor license.
Right.
The Tavern League is not a big fan of that because they think that's unfair that they have to have a liquor license when, in their minds, you guys are doing the same thing. This controversy flared up when Brad Schimmel, on his way out the door, issued an informal opinion saying, no, he believes these people should have liquor licenses. So with Evers coming in, the question was, okay, well, what are you guys going to do? They got sued mid-January, and they kept kind of saying, we're studying the issue. Well, we got a first hint this week when the Evers folks, represented by DOJ, said, we think this lawsuit should be dismissed because there's no controversy. So I kind of kept following up, well, what's that mean? It means, asking the administration, they're not going to pursue requiring liquor licenses from wedding barns. Now, I'm sure the tavern's not going to be very happy about that, but for wedding barns, they got to be thrilled because you have the enforcement folks saying, we're not going to go after you. Now, here's the caveat. The people at Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty who brought the lawsuit to wedding barn owners say, this is not enough. They want an affirmative, does the law, how's the law, because there's a law that says what a public place is. Doesn't yes. define public place.
Right.
They want Evers to go farther to give more assurances so they're continuing the lawsuit on behalf of wedding barns. They have that definition.
Yes, and when you read the state response, it's absolutely fascinating. A wedding barn, first of all, it's not open to the public. Those people invited to the wedding, there's no charge for the alcohol. Therefore, e.g., it is not a public place. It's just a fascinating argument. It's very controversial. It's very emotional. Some wedding barns are saying, we have had to comply and get licenses, and others have said no.
This is an issue that cuts across party lines. So it's not like all Republicans want this and all Democrats want
this. You are absolutely right.
Depends what you have, how many you have in your backyard sometimes. And there's an also complicating factor of how would you craft a law to make sure you only target wedding barns and not other things? This is a problem last time. At the end of last session, there was this last-minute bill that would have extended winery hours, but also would have addressed this issue.
Yep.
But in the analysis, concerns were raised, it would actually impact tailgating at Lambeau Field, because if I go park in some guy's yard, and I pay $20 every Sunday when I go up to a game, I pay to park in your yard, do you have to have a liquor license if I drink a couple beers in your front yard before I go to the game?
And that made it so radioactive. We're not...
How do you deal with, like, okay, I have a big family on my mom's side. When we have a gathering, if we rent a public facility or private facility to have a family function, and we all bring a case of beer per family.
Alcohol would be served at one of your family.
Shocker, I know.
Yeah.
But do you have to have a liquor license for that? Those are all kind of, I mean,
I know.
The door is open to that kind of stuff, and that complicates the issue.
It's a big deal. Okay, mixed.
So, Evers, we talked about this a little bit, but he's been kind of out there getting these headlines about the budget. I mean, you get a good rollout. You can get some headlines for a while. But there are some warning signs of, like, Evers has to tighten up his message operation, start thinking ahead on things, because at some point, Republicans get this budget in their hands, and they have the opportunity to start driving the message more than he can, unless he gets a little bit better on some things. For example, why do you not release a handwritten letter from Scott Walker when asked for it? Small thing. I mean, this is very trivial. This is inside the Madison bubble. But it's an example of not having the foresight of, this is going to cause a controversy you don't need. What was in that letter? Tony, don't forget your friends from before you're in politics.
It was a very cordial note.
So why not release it?
It was a well-meaning note.
Things like that. He said this week he's not going to meet with Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald weekly like his predecessor did. Okay, you know, we all get that they don't have a lot in common. Like, he and Robin Voss are not going to be pen pals when this is all said and done. However, if you ran for governor saying, I can reach across the aisle and get things done for Wisconsinites, why aren't you making the effort to do that, even if it's you know, somewhat superficial. But if you want to get a budget that's done, that you can get compromise on, mm-hmm. you have to build a relationship that opens a door to that compromise. With no relationship, it's harder to do. Just little things like that you're seeing.
So you're going to look for whether he and his team get better at this.
Yes, it's a question I keep getting. At what point, and every governor, look, he is not alone. Every governor struggles early on with messaging, with having that looking down the road three steps, not just what's right in front of you, because you're drinking from a fire hose, just trying to get through every day. At some point, though, you have to kind of turn that valve and start getting a couple steps ahead and not just being reacting to things.
Right. Okay. Falling.
So Brian Hagedorn, so look, we had before that the realtors weren't going to come spend money in this race with Brian Hagedorn. Actually asked for his donation back, pulled his endorsement because of blog posts he's had in the past, plus association with the school that prohibits employees and students from being in a gay relationship. Now, Hagedorn's been saying this attack on my faith, he's trying to turn this around as a religious test in his supporters, as a litmus test for office. But we got more hits for Brian Hagedorn this week. One, the National Associated Manufacturers is not going to come in and spend money. It often puts money through WMC, sorry, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is a big player in these races, that then that helps a conservative candidate most of the time. So what we're seeing is we're seeing liberal groups put down a marker of what they're going to do. I counted three groups over the weekend that had started doing canvassing, reported like $230,000 in canvassing costs. We have Eric Holder's group now saying it's going to spend $350,000 in Wisconsin.
It's a lot of digits.
It is, but in the picture of a whole campaign, it's not huge.
But it's a low turnout April election, excuse me.
We're now seeing the Greater Wisconsin Committee up on TV with two ads. So we're seeing these markers from liberal groups of what they're going to do. We haven't seen an equal response from conservatives. Americans for Prosperity is doing stuff, but it's not, at least yet. I mean, they got to file reports on a regular basis. We haven't seen the same level of spending going on. Unless there's an effort that matches the liberals, it's a very narrow path to victory for Hagedorn. Now, a couple things to watch. One, he's been raising money a good clip for a Supreme Court candidate, so he's going to have his own money. That
he
might
help.
He told
the press club in Milwaukee, we've got good fundraising numbers.
Two, I hear his backers saying, hey, you know, there's still a chance to get some deep-pocketed local donors to put forth some money that can be scraped together with others that can put something in the air. So there's that option. And the other thing is with Neubauer, she's running a very traditional Supreme Court campaign, the one we saw a decade ago, where you talk about your endorsements, especially from judges and law enforcement. You don't talk about issues, you talk about experience. Will that excite the liberal base to turn out in April? Because low turnout. You need excitement. Is that going to excite people? Or will the attacks on Hagedorn, will that excite the liberal base to turn out? And with him, the hits keep coming. We found a blog post this week that he wrote in 2006, I think around the time he was a law student at Northwestern, saying that the Mormon theology was basically heresy. You know, that's going to sit well with some people, especially for a guy saying, my faith is being attacked. You write something like that about somebody else's faith, what's that mean? But right now, we're just not seeing the equal effort that would say, okay, there's the path for Brian Hagedorn. Now, don't write this race off. It's a low turnout. And oh, by the way, conservatives feel like the Evers budget has induced some new juice in their base because they're seeing, okay, look at all this spending. There's some juice there, but they got to have a way to capture it in April.
Okay, and a programming note, Wisconsin and I will be covering and I'll be moderating a debate between Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn March 19th at the Milwaukee Bar Association. Okay, real quickly, looking ahead next week, Don Crim's confirmation hearing, mm-hmm. and do you think we'll hear whether Milwaukee's going to get the Democratic National Convention?
I was told that we were going to hear a week or two ago.
Okay,
so
that's up
who
for
knows?
Grabs.
Yeah,
that's up for grabs. I'm Steve Walders.
I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for, what's the date, J.R.?
March 8th.
Thank you.
Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.